these days. Chris went red. I'm leaving. I don't have to listen to that. Desjardins had not been able to get the image of Carrie out of her mind all weekend. Carrie screaming, blubbering, a wet napkin plastered squarely in the middle of her pubic hair, and her own sick, angry reaction. And now, as Chris tried to storm out past her, she reached out and slammed her against a row of dented, olive-colored lockers beside the inner door. Chris's eyes widened with shocked disbelief. Then a kind of insane rage filled her face. "You can't hit us," she screamed. "You'll get canned for this. See if you don't, you bitch." The other girls winced and sucked breath and stared at the floor. It was getting out of hand. Sue noticed out of the corner of her eye that Mary and Donna Thibodeau were holding hands. "I don't really care, Hargensen," Desjardins said. "If you or any of you girls think I'm wearing my teacher hat right now, you're making a bad mistake. I just want you all to know that you did a shitty thing on Friday. A really shitty thing." Chris Hargensen was sneering at the floor. The rest of the girls were looking miserably at anything but their gym instructor. Sue found herself looking into the shower stall, the scene of the crime, and jerked her glance elsewhere. None of them had ever heard a teacher call anything shitty before. "Did any of you stop to think that Carrie White has feelings? Did any of you ever stop to think? Sue? Fern? Helen? Jessica? Any of you? You think she's ugly. Well, you're all ugly. I saw it on Friday morning." Chris Hargensen was mumbling about her father being a lawyer. "Shut up!" Desjardins yelled in her face. Chris recoiled so suddenly that her head struck the lockers behind her. She began to whine and rub her head. "One more remark out of you," Desjardins said softly, "and I'll throw you across the room. Want to find out if I'm telling the truth?" Chris, who had apparently decided she was dealing with a madwoman, said nothing. Desjardins put her hands on her hips. "The office has decided on punishment for you girls. Not my punishment, I'm sorry to say. My idea was 3 days suspension and refusal of your prom tickets." Several girls looked at each other and muttered unhappily. "That would have hit you where you live," Desjardins continued. "Unfortunately, UN is staffed completely by men in its administration wing. I don't believe they have any real conception of how utterly nasty what you did was. So, 1 week's detention." Spontaneous sighs of relief. "But it's to be my detention, in the gym, and I'm gonna run you ragged." "I won't come," Chris said. Her lips had thinned across her teeth. "That's up to you, Chris. That's up to all of you. But punishment for skipping detention is going to be 3 days suspension and refusal of your prom ticket. Get the picture?" No one said anything. "Right. Change up and think about what I said." She left. Utter silence for a long and stricken moment. Then Chris Hargensen said with loud, hysterical stridency, "She can't get away with it." She opened a door at random, pulled out a pair of sneakers, and hurled them across the room. "I'm going to get her. God damn it. God damn it. See if I don't. If we all stick together, we can..." "Shut up, Chris," Sue said, and was shocked to hear a dead, adult lifelessness in her voice. "Just shut up." "This isn't over," Chris Hargensen said, unzipping her skirt with a rough jab and reaching for her fashionably frayed green gym shorts. "This isn't over by a long way." And she was right. From The Shadow Exploded, pages 60 to 61. In the opinion of this researcher, a great many of the people who have researched the Carrie White matter, either for the scientific journals or for the popular press, have placed a mistaken emphasis on a relatively fruitless search for incidents of telekinesis in the girl's childhood. To strike a rough analogy, this is like spending years researching the early incidents of masturbation in a rapist's childhood. The spectacular incident of the stone serves as a kind of red herring in this respect. Many researchers have adopted the erroneous belief that where there has been one incident, there must be others. To offer another analogy, this is like dispatching a crew of meteor watchers to Crater National Park because a huge asteroid struck there 2 million years ago. To the best of my knowledge, there are no other recorded instances of TK in Carrie's childhood. If Carrie had not been an only child, we might have at least hearsay reports of dozens of other minor occurrences. In the case of Andrea Collins, see Appendix 2 for a fuller history, we are told that, following a spanking for crawling out on the roof, the medicine cabinet flew open, bottles fell to the floor or seemed to hurl themselves across the bathroom. Doors flew open and slammed shut, and at the climax of the manifestation, a 300-pound stereo cabinet tipped over and records flew all over the living room, dive-bombing the occupants and shattering against the walls. Significantly, this report is from one of Andrea's brothers, as quoted in the September 4, 1955 issue of Life magazine. Life is hardly the most scholarly or unimpeachable source, but there is a great deal of other documentation, and I think that the point of familiar witnessship is served. In the case of Carrie White, the only witness to any possible prologue to the final climactic events was Margaret White. And she, of course, is dead. Henry Grail, principal of UN High School, had been expecting him all week. But Chris Hargensen's father didn't show up until Friday, the day after Chris had skipped her detention period with the formidable Miss Disjardin. "Yes, Miss Fish?" He spoke formally into the intercom, although he could see the man in the outer office through his window and certainly knew his face from pictures in the local paper. "John Hargensen to see you, Mr. Grail. Send him in, please." "God damn it, Fish, do you have to sound so impressed?" Grail was an irrepressible paperclip bender, napkin ripper, corner folder. For John Hargensen, the town's leading legal light, he was bringing up the heavy ammunition, a whole box of heavy-duty clips in the middle of his desk blotter. Hargensen was a tall, impressive man with a self-confident way of moving and the kind of sure, mobile features that said this was a man superior at the game of one-step-ahead social interaction. He was wearing a brown Savile Row suit with subtle glints of green and gold running through the weave that put Grail's local off-the-rack job to shame. His briefcase was thin, real leather, and bound with glittering stainless steel. The smile was faultless and full of many capped teeth, a smile to make the hearts of lady jurors melt like butter in a warm skillet. His grip was major league all the way, firm, warm, long. "Mr. Grail, I've wanted to meet you for some time now." "Well, I'm always glad to see interested parents," Grail said with a dry smile. "That's why we have parents' open house every October." "Of course," Hargensen smiled. "I imagine you're a busy man, and I have to be in court 45 minutes from now. Shall we get down to specifics?" "Surely." Grail dipped into his box of clips and began to mangle the first one. "I suppose you're here concerning the disciplinary action against your daughter Christine. You should be informed that school policy on the matter has been set. As a man concerned with the workings of justice yourself, you should realize that bending the rules is hardly possible, or—" Hargensen waved his hand impatiently. "Apparently you're laboring under a misconception, Mr. Grail. I'm here because my daughter was manhandled by your gym teacher, Miss Rita Disjardin, and verbally abused, I'm afraid. I believe the term your Miss Disjardin used in connection with my daughter was shitty." Grail sighed inwardly. "Miss Disjardin has been reprimanded." John Hargensen's smile cooled 30 degrees. "I'm afraid a reprimand will not be sufficient. I believe this has been the young, lady's first year in a teaching capacity?" "Yes, we have found her to be eminently satisfactory." "Apparently your definition of eminently satisfactory includes throwing students up against lockers and the ability to curse like a sailor?" Grail fenced. "As a lawyer, you must be aware that this state acknowledges the school's title to in loco parentis. Along with full responsibility, we succeed to full parental rights during school hours. If you're not familiar, I'd advise you to check Monadnock Consolidated School District versus Crane Pool, or I'm familiar with the concept, Hargensen said. I'm also aware that neither the Crane Pool case, that you administrators are so fond of quoting, or the Frick case cover anything remotely concerned with physical or verbal abuse. There is, however, the case of School District Number 4 versus David. Are you familiar with it? Grail was. George Kramer, the assistant principal of the Consolidated High School in SD 14, was a poker buddy. George wasn't playing much poker anymore. He was working for an insurance company after taking it upon himself to cut a student's hair. The school district had ultimately paid $7,000 in damages, or about $1,000 a snip. Grail started on another paperclip. Let's not quote cases at each other, Mr. Grail. We're busy men. I don't want a lot of unpleasantness. I don't want a mess. My daughter is at home, and she will stay there Monday and Tuesday. That will complete her 3-day suspension. That's all right. Another dismissive wave of the hand. Catch, Fido. Good boy. Here's a nice bone. Here's what I want, Hargensen continued. 1, prom tickets for my daughter. A girl's senior prom is important to her, and Chris is very distressed. 2, no contract renewal of the Desjardins woman. That's for me. I believe that if I cared to take the school department to court, I could walk out with both her dismissal and a hefty damage settlement in my pocket. But I don't want to be vindictive. So court is the alternative if I don't agree to your demands? I understand that a school committee hearing would precede that, but only as a formality. But yes, court would be the final result. Nasty for you. Another paperclip. For physical and verbal abuse, is that correct? Essentially. Mr. Hargensen, are you aware that your daughter and about 10 of her peers threw sanitary napkins at a girl who was having her first menstrual period? A girl who was under the impression that she was bleeding to death? A faint frown creased Hargensen's features, as if someone had spoken in a distant room. I hardly think such an allegation is at issue. I'm speaking of actions following. Never mind, girl said. Never mind what you were speaking of. This girl, Carrietta White, was called a dumb pudding and was told to plug it up and was subjected to various obscene gestures. She's not been in school this week at all. Does that sound like physical and verbal abuse to you? It does to me. I don't intend, Hargensen said, to sit here and listen to a tissue of half-truths or your standard schoolmaster lecture, Mr. Grail. I know my daughter well enough to hear. Grail reached into the wire in-basket beside the blotter and tossed a sheaf of pink cards across the desk. I doubt very much if you know the daughter represented in these cards half so well as you think you do. If you did, you might realize that it was about time for a trip to the woodshed. It's time you snubbed her close before she does someone a major damage. You aren't. Ewan, 4 years, Grail overrode him. Graduation slated June 79, next month. Tested IQ of 140. 83 average. Nonetheless, I see she's been accepted at Oberlin. I'd guess someone, probably you, Mr. Hargensen, has been yanking some pretty long strings. 74 assigned detentions. 20 of those have been for harassment of misfit pupils, I might add. Fifth wheels. I understand that Chris's clique calls them Mortimer Snerds. They find it all quite hilarious. She skipped out on 51 of those assigned detentions. At Chamberlain Junior High, 1 suspension for putting a firecracker in a girl's shoe. The note on the card says that little prank almost cost a little girl named Irma Swope 2 toes. The Swope girl has a hair lip, I understand. I'm talking about your daughter, Mr. Hargensen. Does that tell you anything? Yes, Hargensen said, rising. A thin flush had suffused his features. It tells me I'll see you in court. And when I'm done with you, you'll be lucky to get a job selling encyclopedias door to door. Grail also rose, angrily, and the 2 men faced each other across the desk. Let it be court, then, Grail said. He noted a faint flick of surprise on Hawkinson's face, crossed his fingers, and went in for what he hoped would be a knockout. or at least a TKO that would save Desjardins' job and take this silk-ass son of a bitch down a notch. You apparently haven't realized all the implications of in loco parentis in this matter, Mr. Harkinson. The same umbrella that covers your daughter also covers Carrie White. And the minute you file for damages on the grounds of physical and verbal abuse, we will cross-file against your daughter on those same grounds for Carrie White. Harkinson's mouth dropped open, then closed. You can't get away with a cheap gimmick like that, you shyster lawyer. Is that the phrase you were looking for? Grail smiled grimly. I believe you know your way out, Mr. Harkinson. The sanctions against your daughter stand. If you care to take the matter further, that's your right. Harkinson crossed the room stiffly, paused as if to add something, then left, barely restraining himself from the satisfaction of a hard door slam. Grail blew out breath. It wasn't hard to see where Chris Harkinson came by her self-willed stubbornness. A.P. Morton entered a minute later. How did it go?
Time will tell, Morty, Grail said. Grimacing, he looked at the twisted pile of paper clips.
He was good for 7 clips, anyway. That's some kind of record.
Is he going to make it a civil matter?
Don't know. It rocked him when I said we'd cross, Sue. I bet it did.
Morton glanced at the phone on Grail's desk. It's time we let the superintendent in on this bag of garbage, isn't it?
Yes, Grail said, picking up the phone. Thank God my unemployment insurance is paid up.
Me too, Morton said loyally.
From the Shadow Exploded, Appendix 3. Carrietta White passed in the following short verse as a poetry assignment in the 7th grade. Mr. Edwin King, who had Carrie for grade 7 English, says, I don't know why I saved it. She certainly doesn't stick out in my mind as a superior pupil, and this isn't a superior verse. She was very quiet, and I can't remember her ever raising her hand even once in class. But something in this seemed to cry out.
Jesus watches from the wall, but his face is cold as stone. And if he loves me, as she tells me, why do I feel so all alone?
The border of the paper on which this little verse is written is decorated with a great many cruciform figures which almost seem to dance. Tommy was at baseball practice Monday afternoon, and Sue went down to the Kelly Fruit Company in the center to wait for him. Kelly's was the closest thing to a high school hangout the loosely sprawled community of Chamberlain could boast, since Sheriff Doyle had closed the rec center following a large drug bust. It was run by a morose fat man named Hubert Kelly, who dyed his hair black and complained constantly that his electronic pacemaker was on the verge of electrocuting him. The place was a combination grocery, soda fountain, and gas station. There was a rusted Jenny gas pump out front that Hubie had never bothered to change when the company merged. He also sold beer, cheap wine, dirty books, and a wide selection of obscure cigarettes, such as Murad's, King Sano, and Marvel Straits. The soda fountain was a slab of real marble, and there were 4 or 5 booths for kids unlucky enough, or friendless enough, to have no place to go and get drunk or stoned. An ancient pinball machine that always tilted on the third ball, stuttered lights on and off in the back beside the rack of dirty books. When Sue walked in, she saw Chris Harkinson immediately. She was sitting in one of the back booths. Her current amour, Billy Nolan, was looking through the latest issue of Popular Mechanics at the magazine rack. Sue didn't know what a rich, popular girl like Chris saw in Nolan, who was like some strange time traveler from the 1950s, with his greased hair, zipper-bejeweled black leather jacket, and manifold, bubbling Chevrolet road machine. "Sue," Chris hailed, "come on over." Sue nodded and raised a hand, although dislike rose in her throat like a paper snake. Looking at Chris was like looking through a slanted doorway to a place where Carrie White crouched with hands over her head. Predictably, she found her own hypocrisy and hair in the wave and the nod. Incomprehensible and sickening. Why couldn't she just cut her dead? "A dime root beer," she told Hubie, Hubie had genuine draft root beer, and he served it in huge, frosted 1890s mugs. She'd been looking forward to tipping a long one while she read a paper novel and waited for Tommy. In spite of the havoc the root beers raised with her complexion, she was hooked. But she wasn't surprised to find she'd lost her taste for this one. "How's your heart, Hubie?" she asked. "You kids," Hubie said, scraping the head off Sue's beer with a table knife and filling the mug the rest of the way. "You don't understand nothing. I plugged in my electric razor this morning and got 110 volts right through this pacemaker. You kids don't know what that's like, am I right?"
"I guess not."
"No, Christ Jesus forbid you should ever have to find out. How long can my old ticker take it? You kids will all find out when I buy the farm and those urban renewal poops turn this place into a parking lot. That's a dime." She pushed her dime across the marble. 50 million volts right up the old tubes," Hubie said darkly, and stared down at the small bulge in his breast pocket. Sue went over and slid carefully into the vacant side of Chris's booth. She was looking exceptionally pretty, her black hair held by a shamrock green band and a tight basque blouse that accentuated her firm, upthrust breasts. "How are you, Chris?"
"Bitchin' good," Chris said a little too blithely.
"You heard the latest? I'm out of the prom. I bet that cocksucker Grail loses his job, though." Sue had heard the latest, along with everyone at Ewan.
"Daddy's suing them," Chris went on, over her shoulder. "Billy, come over here and say hi to Sue."
He dropped his magazine and sauntered over, thumbs hooked into his side-hitched garrison belt, fingers dangling limply toward the stuffed crotch of his pegged Levi's. Sue felt a wave of unreality surge over her and fought an urge to put her hands to her face and giggle madly.
"Hi, Sue's," Billy said. He slid in beside Chris and immediately began to massage her shoulder. His face was utterly blank. He might have been testing a cut of beef.
"I think we're going to crash the prom anyway," Chris said, "as a protest or something."
"Is that right?"
Sue was frankly startled.
"No," Chris replied, dismissing it. "I don't know."
Her face suddenly twisted into an expression of fury, as abrupt and surprising as a tornado funnel.
"That goddamn Carrie White. I wish she'd take her goddamn Holy Joe routine and stuff it straight up her ass."
"You'll get over it," Sue said.
"If only the rest of you had walked out with me. Jesus, Sue, why didn't you? We could have had 'em by the balls. I never figured you for an establishment pawn."
Sue felt her face grow hot.
"I don't know about anyone else, but I wasn't being anybody's pawn. I took the punishment because I thought I earned it. We did a suck-off thing. End of statement."
"Bullshit. That fucking Carrie runs around saying everyone but her and her gilt-edged mama are going to hell. And you can stick up for her? We should have taken those rags and stuffed them down her throat."
"Sure, yeah. See you around, Chris."
She pushed out of the booth. This time it was Chris who colored. The blood slammed to her face in a sudden rush, as if a red cloud had passed over some inner sun.
"Aren't you getting to be the Joan of Arc around here? I seem to remember you were in there pitching with the rest of us."
"Yes," Sue said, trembling, "but I stopped."
"Oh, aren't you just it?" Chris marveled.
"Oh, my, yes. Take your root beer with you. I'm afraid I might touch it and turn to gold."
She didn't take her root beer. She turned and half walked, half stumbled out. The upset inside her was very great, too great yet for either tears or anger. She was a get-along girl, and it was the first fight she had been in, physical or verbal, since grade school pigtail pulling. And it was the first time in her life that she had actively espoused a principle. And of course Chris had hit her in just the right place. Had hit her exactly where she was most vulnerable. She was being a hypocrite. There seemed no way to avoid that. And deeply, sheathed within her, and hateful, was the knowledge that one of the reasons she had gone to Miss Desjardins' hour of calisthenics and sweating runs around the gym floor had nothing to do with nobility. She wasn't going to miss her last spring ball for anything. Not for anything. Tommy was nowhere in sight. She began to walk back toward the school, her stomach churning unhappily.
Little Miss Sorority, Susie Cream Cheese, the nice girl who only does it with the boy she plans to marry, with the proper Sunday supplement coverage, of course. Two kids. Beat the living shit out of them if they show any signs of honesty, screwing, fighting, or refusing to grin each time some mythic honcho yelled frog. Spring ball. Blue gown. Corsage kept all the afternoon in the fridge. Tommy in a white dinner jacket, cummerbund, black pants, black shoes. Parents taking photos posed by the living room sofa with Kodak star flashes and Polaroid big shots. Crepe masking the stark gymnasium girders. Two bands, one rock, one mellow. No fifth wheels need apply. Mortimer Snurd, please keep out. Aspiring country club members and future residents of Clean Corners Only. The tears finally came, and she began to run. From The Shadow Exploded, page 60. The following excerpt is from a letter to Donna Kellogg from Christine Hargensen. The Kellogg girl moved from Chamberlain to Providence, Rhode Island in the fall of 1978. She was apparently one of Chris Hargensen's few close friends and a confidant. The letter is postmarked May 17, 1979. So I'm out of the prom, and my yellow guts father says he won't give them what they deserve. But they're not going to get away with it. I don't know exactly what I'm going to do yet, but I guarantee you everyone is going to get a big fucking surprise. It was the 17th, May 17th. She crossed the day off the calendar in her room as soon as she slipped into her long white nightgown. She crossed off each day as it passed with a heavy black felt pen, and she supposed it expressed a very bad attitude toward life. She didn't really care. The only thing she really cared about was knowing that Mama was going to make her go back to school tomorrow, and she would have to face all of them. She sat down in the small Boston rocker, bought and paid for with her own money, beside the window, closed her eyes, and swept them and all the clutter of her conscious thoughts from her mind. It was like sweeping a floor. Lift the rug of your subconscious and sweep all the dirt under. Goodbye. She opened her eyes. She looked at the hairbrush on her bureau. Flex. She was lifting the hairbrush. It was heavy. It was like lifting a barbell with very weak arms. Oh, grunt. The hairbrush slid to the edge of the bureau, slid out past the point where gravity should have toppled it, and then dangled, as if on an invisible string. Carrie's eyes had closed to slits. Veins pulsed in her temples. A doctor might have been interested in what her body was doing at that instant. It made no rational sense. Respiration had fallen to 16 breaths per minute. Blood pressure up to 190 over 100. Heartbeat up to 140, higher than astronauts under the heavy G-load of liftoff. Temperature down to 94.3 degrees. Her body was burning energy that seemed to be coming from nowhere and seemed to be going nowhere. An electroencephalogram would have shown alpha waves that were no longer waves at all, but great jagged spikes. She let the hairbrush down carefully. Good. Last night she had dropped it. Lose all your points. Go to jail. She closed her eyes again and rocked. Physical functions began to revert to the norm. Her respiration speeded until she was nearly panting. The rocker had a slight squeak. Wasn't annoying, though. Was soothing. Rock. Rock. Clear your mind. Carrie! Her mother's voice, slightly disturbed, floated up. She's getting interference like the radio when you turn on the blender. Good. Good. Have you said your prayers, Carrie?
I'm saying them, she called back.
Yes, she was saying them, all right. She looked at her small studio bed. Flex. Tremendous weight. Huge. Unbearable. The bed trembled and then the end came up perhaps 3 inches. It dropped with a crash. She waited, a small smile playing about her lips, for Mama to call upstairs angrily. She didn't, so Carrie got up, went to her bed, and slid between the cool sheets. Her head ached and she felt giddy, as she always did after these exercise sessions. Her heart was pounding in a fierce, scary way. She reached over, turned off the light, and lay back. No pillow. Mama didn't allow her a pillow. She thought of imps and familiars and witches. Am I a witch, Mama, the devil's whore? Riding through the night, souring milk, overturning butter churns, blighting crops while they huddled inside their houses with hex signs scrawled on their doors. She closed her eyes, slept, and dreamed of huge, living stones crashing through the night, seeking out Mama, seeking out them. They were trying to run, trying to hide, but the rock would not hide them. The dead tree gave no shelter. From My Name is Susan Snell by Susan Snell, New York, Simon & Schuster, 1986, pages 1 to 4. There's one thing no one has understood about what happened in Chamberlain on prom night. The press hasn't understood it. The scientists at Duke University haven't understood it. David Congress hasn't understood it, although his The Shadow Exploded is probably the only half-decent book written on the subject. And certainly, the White Commission, which used me as a handy scapegoat, did not understand it. This one thing is the most fundamental fact. We were kids. Carrie was 17. Chris Hargensen was 17. I was 17. Tommy Ross was 18. Billy Nolan, who spent a year repeating the ninth grade, presumably before he learned how to shoot his cuffs during examinations, was 19. Older kids react in more socially acceptable ways than younger kids, but they still have a way of making bad decisions, of overreacting, of underestimating. In the first section which follows this introduction, I must show these tendencies in myself as well as I am able. Yet the matter which I am going to discuss is at the root of my involvement in prom night, and if I am to clear my name, I must begin by recalling scenes which I find particularly painful. I've told this story before, most notoriously before the White Commission, which received it with incredulity. In the wake of 200 deaths and the destruction of an entire town, it is so easy to forget one thing. We were kids. We were kids. We were kids trying to do our best. You must be crazy. He blinked at her, not willing to believe that he had actually heard it. They were at his house, and the television was on, but forgotten. His mother had gone over to visit Mrs. Klein across the street. His father was in the cellar workroom making a birdhouse. Sue looked uncomfortable, but determined. It's the way I want it, Tommy. Well, it's not the way I want it. I think it's the craziest goddamn thing I've ever heard. Like something you might do on a bet. Her face tightened. Oh, I thought you were the one making the big speeches the other night. But when it comes to putting your money where your big fat mouth is, wait, whoa. He was unoffended, grinning. I didn't say no, did I? Not yet, anyway. You, wait, just wait, let me talk. You want me to ask Carrie White to the spring ball? Okay, I've got that. But there's a couple of things I don't understand. Name them. She leaned forward. First, what good would it do? And second, what makes you think she'd say yes if I asked her? Not say yes? Why, she floundered. You're... everybody likes you, and... We both know Carrie's got no reason to care much for people that everybody likes. She'd go with you. Why? Pressed, she looked defiant and proud at the same time. I've seen the way she looks at you. She's got a crush, like half the girls at Ewan. He rolled his eyes. Well, I'm just telling you, Sue said defensively. She won't be able to say no. Suppose I believe you, he said. What about the other thing? You mean what good will it do? Why, it'll bring her out of her shell, of course. Make her... She trailed off. A part of things? Come on, Suze. You don't believe that bullshit. All right, she said. Maybe I don't. but maybe I still think I've got something to make up for. The shower room? A lot more than that. Maybe if that was all, I could let it go. But the mean tricks have been going on ever since grammar school. I wasn't in on many of them, but I was on some. If I'd been in Carrie's groups, I bet I would have been in on even more. It seemed like, oh, a big laugh. Girls can be cat mean about that sort of thing, and boys don't really understand. The boys would tease Carrie for a little while and then forget, but the girls, it went on and on and on, and I can't even remember where it started anymore. If I were Carrie, I couldn't even face showing myself to the world. I'd just find a big rock and hide under it. You were kids, he said. Kids don't know what they're doing. Kids don't even know their reactions really actually hurt other people. They have no, empathy, Dig. She found herself struggling to express the thought this called up in her, for it suddenly seemed basic, bulking over the shower room incident the way sky bulks over mountains. But hardly anybody ever finds out that their actions really actually hurt other people. People don't get better, they just get smarter. When you get smarter, you don't stop pulling the wings off flies, you just think of better reasons for doing it. Lots of kids say they feel sorry for Carrie White, mostly girls, and that's a laugh. But I bet none of them understand what it's like to be Carrie White, every second of every day, and they don't really care. Do you? I don't know, she cried, but someone ought to try and be sorry in a way that counts, in a way that means something. All right, I'll ask her. You will? The statement came out in a flat, surprised way. She had not thought he actually would. Yes, but I think she'll say no. You've overestimated my box office appeal. That popularity stuff is bullshit. You've got a bee in your bonnet about that. Thank you, she said, and it sounded odd, as if she had thanked an inquisitor for torture. I love you, he said. She looked at him startled. It was the first time he'd said it. For My Name is Susan Snell, page 6. There are lots of people, mostly men, who aren't surprised that I asked Tommy to take Carrie to the spring ball. They are surprised that he did it, though, which shows you that the male mind expects very little in the way of altruism from its fellows. Tommy took her because he loved me and because it was what I wanted. How, asked the skeptic from the balcony, did you know he loved you? Because he told me so, mister, and if you'd known him, that would have been good enough for you, too. He asked her on Thursday, after lunch, and found himself as nervous as a kid going to his first ice cream party. She sat 4 rows over from him in Period 5 study hall, and when it was over, he cut across to her through the mass of rushing bodies. At the teacher's desk, Mr. Stevens, a tall man just beginning to run to fat, was folding papers abstractedly back into his ratty brown briefcase. Carrie? Oh? She looked up from her books with a startled wince, as if expecting a blow. The day was overcast, and the bank of fluorescence embedded in the ceiling was not particularly kind to her pale complexion. But he saw for the first time, because it was the first time he had really looked, that she was far from repulsive. Her face was round rather than oval, and the eyes were so dark that they seemed to cast shadows beneath them, like bruises. Her hair was darkish blonde, slightly wiry, pulled back in a bun that was not becoming to her. The lips were full, almost lush, the teeth naturally white. Her body, for the most part, was indeterminate. A baggy sweater concealed her breasts, except for token nubs. The skirt was colorful, but awful all the same. It fell to a 1958 mid-shin hem in an odd and clumsy A-line. The calves were strong and rounded. The attempt to conceal these with heathery knee socks was bizarre, but unsuccessful. And handsome. She was looking up with an expression that was slightly fearful, slightly something else. He was quite sure he knew what the something else was. Sue had been right, and being right, he had just time to wonder if this was doing a kindness or making things even worse. If you don't have a date for the ball, would you want to go with me? Now she blinked, and as she did so,
a strange thing happened. The time it took to happen could have been no more than the doorway to a second, but afterward he had no trouble recalling it, as one does with dreams or the sensation of déjà vu. He felt a dizziness, as if his mind was no longer controlling his body. The miserable, out-of-control feeling he associated with drinking too much and then coming to the vomiting point. Then it was gone. What? What? She wasn't angry, at least. He had expected a brief gust of rage and then a sweeping retreat. But she wasn't angry. She seemed unable to cope with what he had said at all. They were alone in the study hall now, perfectly between the ebb of old students and the flow of new ones. "The spring ball," he said, a little shaken. "It's next Friday, and I know this is late notice, but I don't like to be tricked," she said softly and lowered her head. She hesitated for just a second and then passed him by. She stopped and turned, and he suddenly saw dignity in her, something so natural that he doubted if she was even aware of it. "Do you people think you can just go on tricking me forever? I know who you go around with." "I don't go around with anyone I don't want to," Tommy said patiently. "I'm asking you because I want to ask you." Ultimately, he knew this to be the truth. If Sue was making a gesture of atonement, she was doing it only at second hand. The Period 6 students were coming in now, and some of them were looking over curiously. Dale Ullman said something to a boy Tommy didn't know, and both of them snickered. "Come on," Tommy said. They walked out into the hall. They were halfway to Wing 4. His class was the other way, walking together but perhaps only by accident, when she said almost too quietly to hear, "I'd love to, love to." He was perceptive enough to know it was not an acceptance, and again doubt assailed him. Still, it was started. "Do it, then. It will be all right, for both of us. We'll see to it." "No," she said, and in her sudden pensiveness, she could have been mistaken for beautiful. "It will be a nightmare." "I don't have tickets," he said, as if he hadn't heard. "This is the last day they sell them." "Hey, Tommy, you're going the wrong way," Brent Gillian yelled. She stopped. "You're going to be late." "Will you?" "Your class," she said, distraught. "Your class, the bell is going to ring." "Will you?" "Yes," she said with angry helplessness. "You knew I would." She swiped at her eyes with the back of her hand. "No," he said, "but now I do. I'll pick you up at 7:30. "Fine," she whispered. "Thank you." She looked as if she might swoon. And then, more uncertain than ever, he touched her hand. From The Shadow Exploded, pages 74 to 76. Probably no other aspect of the Carrie White affair has been so misunderstood, second-guessed, and shrouded in mystery as the part played by Thomas Everett Ross, Carrie's ill-starred escort to the UN High School spring ball. Morton Cratchbarkin, in an admittedly sensationalized address to the National Colloquium on Psychic Phenomena last year, said that the two most stunning events of the 20th century have been the assassination of John F. Kennedy in 1963 and the destruction that came to Chamberlain, Maine in May of 1979. Cratchbarkin points out that both events were driven home to the citizenry by mass media, and both events have almost shouted the frightening fact that, while something had ended, something else had been irrevocably set in motion, for good or ill. If the comparison can be made, then Thomas Ross played the part of a Lee Harvey Oswald, trigger man in a catastrophe. The question that still remains is, did he do so wittingly or unwittingly? Susan Snell, by her own admission, was to have been escorted by Ross to the annual event. She claims that she suggested Ross take Carrie to make up for her part in the shower room incident. Those who oppose this story, most lately led by George Jerome of Harvard,
claim that this is either a highly romantic distortion or an outright lie. Jerome argues with great force and eloquence that it is hardly typical of high school age adolescents to feel that they have to atone for anything, particularly for an offense against a peer who has been ostracized from existing cliques. It would be uplifting if we could believe that adolescent human nature is capable of salvaging the pride and self-image of the low bird in the pecking order with such a gesture, Jerome has said in a recent issue of the Atlantic Monthly. But we know better. The low bird is not picked tenderly out of the dust by its fellows. Rather, it is dispatched quickly and without mercy. Jerome, of course, is absolutely right, about birds at any rate, and his eloquence is undoubtedly responsible in large part for the advancement of the practical joker theory, which the White Commission approached but did not actually state. This theory hypothesizes that Ross and Christine Hargensen, see pages 10 through 18, were at the center of a loose conspiracy to get Kerry White to the spring ball and, once there, complete her humiliation. Some theorists, mostly crime writers, also claim that Sue Snell was an active part of this conspiracy. This casts the mysterious Mr. Ross in the worst possible light, that of a practical joker deliberately maneuvering an unstable girl into a situation of extreme stress. This author doesn't believe that likely in light of Mr. Ross's character. This is a facet which has remained largely unexplored by his detractors, who have painted him as a rather dull, clique-centered athlete. The phrase "dumb jock" expresses this view of Tommy Ross perfectly. It is true that Ross was an athlete of above-average ability. His best sport was baseball, and he was a member of the UN varsity squad from his sophomore year. Dick O'Connell, general manager of the Boston Red Sox, has indicated that Ross would have been offered a fairly large bonus for signing a contract, had he lived. But Ross was also a straight-A student, hardly fitting the dumb jock image, and his parents have both said that he had decided pro baseball would have to wait until he'd finished college, where he planned to study for an English degree. His interests included writing poetry, and a poem written 6 months prior to his death was published in an established little magazine called Everleaf. This is available in Appendix 5. His surviving classmates also give him high marks, and this is significant. There were only 12 survivors of what has become known in the popular press as prom night. Those who were not in attendance were largely the unpopular members of the junior and senior classes. If these outs remember Ross as a friendly, good-natured fellow, many referred to him as a hell of a good shit, does not Professor Jerome's thesis suffer accordingly? Ross's school records, which cannot, according to state law, be photostated here, when taken with classmates' recollections and the comments of relatives, neighbors, and teachers, form a picture of an extraordinary young man. This is a fact that gels very badly with Professor Jerome's picture of a peer-worshipping, sly young tough. He apparently had a high enough tolerance to verbal abuse and enough independence from his peer group to ask Kerry in the first place. In fact, Thomas Ross appears to have been something of a rarity, a socially conscious young man. No case will be made here for his sainthood. There is none to be made, but intensive research has satisfied me that neither was he a human chicken in a public school barnyard, joining mindlessly in the ruin of a weaker hen. She lay, I am not afraid of her, on her bed with an arm thrown over her eyes. It was Saturday night. If she was to make the dress she had in mind, she would have to start tomorrow at the, not afraid, Mama, latest. She had already bought the material at John's in Westover. The heavy, crumpled velvet richness of it frightened her. The price had also frightened her, and she had been intimidated by the size of the place, the chic ladies wandering here and there in their light spring dresses, examining bolts of cloth. There was an echoing strangeness in the atmosphere, and it was worlds from the Chamberlain Woolworths, where she usually bought her material. She was intimidated, but not stopped, because if she wanted to, she could send them all screaming into the streets. Mannequins toppling over, light fixtures falling, bolts of cloth shooting through the air in unwinding streamers. Like Samson in the temple, she could rain destruction on their heads if she so desired. I am not afraid. The package was now hidden on a dry shelf down in the cellar, and she was going to bring it up tonight. She opened her eyes. Flex. The bureau rose into the air, trembled for a moment, and then rose until it nearly touched the ceiling. She lowered it, lifted it, lowered it. Now the bed, complete with her weight. Up, down, up, down. Just like an elevator. She was hardly tired at all. Well, a little. Not much. The ability, almost lost 2 weeks ago, was in full flower. It had progressed at a speed that was, well, almost terrifying. And now, seemingly unbidden, like the knowledge of menstruation, a score of memories had come, as if some mental dam had been knocked down, so that strange waters could gush forth. They were cloudy, distorted little girl memories, but very real for all that, making the pictures dance on the walls, turning on the water faucets from across the room, Mama asking her, "Carrie, shut the windows, it's going to rain." To do something and windows suddenly banging down all over the house, giving Miss McCafferty 4 flat tires all at once by unscrewing the valves and the tires of her Volkswagen. The stones. No, 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 no. But now there was no denying the memory, no more than there could be denying the monthly flow. And that memory was not cloudy, no, not that one. It was harsh and brilliant, like jagged strokes of lightning. The little girl. "Mama, stop. Mama, don't. I can't breathe. Oh, my throat. Oh, Mama, I'm sorry. I looked, Mama. Oh, my tongue. Blood in my mouth." The poor little girl. Screaming, "Little slut. Oh, I know how it is with you. I see what has to be done." The poor little girl lying half in the closet and half out of it, seeing black stars dancing in front of everything, a sweet, faraway buzzing, a swollen tongue lolling between her lips. Throat circled with a bracelet of puffed, abraded flesh, where Mama had throttled her, and then Mama coming back, coming for her, Mama holding Daddy Ralph's long butcher knife. "Cut it out. I have to cut out the evil, the nastiness, sins of the flesh. Oh, I know about that, the eyes. Cut out your eyes." In her right hand, Mama's face twisted and working, drool on her chin, holding Daddy Ralph's Bible in her other hand. "You'll never look at that naked wickedness again." And something flexed. Not flex, but flex. Something huge and unformed and titanic. A wellspring of power that was not hers now and never would be again. And then something on the roof, and Mama screamed and dropped Daddy Ralph's Bible. And that was good. And then more bumps and thumps, and then the house began to throw its furnishings around, and Mama dropped the knife and got on her knees and began to pray, holding up her hands and swaying on her knees while chairs whistled down the hall and the beds upstairs fell over and the dining room table tried to jam itself through a window. And then Mama's eyes growing huge and crazed, bulging, her finger pointing at the little girl. "It's you. It's you, devil spawn, witch imp of the devil. It's you doing it." And then the stones, and Mama had fainted as their roof cracked and thumped as if with the footfalls of God. And then she had fainted herself. And after that, there were no more memories. Mama did not speak of it. The butcher knife was back in its drawer. Mama dressed the huge black and blue bruises on her neck and Carrie thought she could remember asking Mama how she had gotten them, and Mama tightening her lips and saying nothing. Little by little it was forgotten. The eye of memory opened only in dreams. The pictures no longer danced on the walls. The windows did not shut themselves. Carrie did not remember a time when things had been different. Not until now. She lay on her bed, looking at the ceiling, sweating. "Carrie! Supper!"
"Thank you. I am not afraid.
Mama?"
She got up and fixed her hair with a dark blue headband. Then she went downstairs.
From The Shadow Exploded, page 59. How apparent was Carrie's wild talent, and what did Margaret White, with her extreme Christian ethic, think of it? We shall probably never know, but one is tempted to believe that Mrs. White's reaction must have been extreme.
"You haven't touched your pie, Carrie."
Mama looked up from the tract she had been perusing while she drank her constant comment. "It's homemade."
"It makes me have pimples, Mama."
"Your pimples are the Lord's way of chastising you. Now eat your pie."
"Mama?"
"Yes."
Carrie plunged. "I've been invited to the spring ball next Friday by Tommy Ross." The tract was forgotten.
Mama was staring at her with wide, "my ears are deceiving me" eyes. Her nostrils flared like those of a horse that has heard the dry rattle of a snake. Carrie tried to swallow an obstruction and only,
"I'm not afraid. Oh, yes, I am."
Got rid of part of it.
"And he's a very nice boy. He's promised to stop in and meet you before and..."
"No."
"To have me in by 11. I've..."
"No. No. No.
Accepted. Mama, please see that I have to start to try and get along with the world. I'm not like you. I'm funny. I mean, the kids think I'm funny. I don't want to be. I want to try and be a person before it's too late."
Mrs. White threw her tea in Carrie's face. It was only lukewarm, but it could not have shut off Carrie's words more suddenly if it had been scalding. She sat numbly, the amber fluid dripping from her chin and cheeks onto her white blouse, spreading. It was sticky and smelled like cinnamon. Mrs. White sat trembling, her face frozen except for her nostrils, which continued to flare. Abruptly, she threw back her head and screamed at the ceiling,
"God! God! God!"
Her jaw snapped brutally over each syllable. Carrie sat without moving. Mrs. White got up and came around the table. Her hands were hooked into shaking claws. Her face bore a half-mad expression of compassion mixed with hate. "The closet," she said. "Go to your closet and pray."
"No, Mama."
"Boys, yes, boys come next. After the blood, the boys come, like sniffing dogs, grinning and slobbering, trying to find out where that smell is. That smell." She swung her whole arm into the blow, and the sound of her palm against Carrie's face.
"Oh, God, I'm so afraid now,"
was like that flat sound of a leather belt being snapped in air. Carrie remained seated, although her upper body swayed. The mark on her cheek was first white, then blood red. "The mark," Mrs. White said. Her eyes were large but blank. She was breathing in rapid, snatching gulps of air. She seemed to be talking to herself as the claw hand descended onto Carrie's shoulder and pulled her out of her chair.
"I've seen it all right. Oh, yes, but I never did. But for him, he took me."
She paused, her eyes wandering vaguely toward the ceiling. Carrie was terrified. Mama seemed in the throes of some great revelation which might destroy her.
"Mama,
in cars. Oh, I know where they take you in their cars. City limits, roadhouses, whiskey, smelling. Oh, they smell it on you." Her voice rose to a scream.
tendons stood out on her neck, and her head twisted in a questing upward rotation. "Mama, you better stop." This seemed to snap her back to some kind of hazy reality.